Chapter 2. Next morning, while Slouchund was at the paper merchant buying some cardboard tubes, Lila went to the elephant house to see Chudak. When she heard what Slouchund had told him, she was furious. "Mount Merpie, Rivanzi, the royal souffleur, and he wasn't going to tell me. Oh, I'll never forgive him." "That's a bit drastic," said Chudak, who was busy making the elephant ready for his new job. "He's only thinking of you. It's dangerous, after all. You won't catch me going up there." "Huh?" she said. "It's all right to let me make golden sneezes and Java lights, I suppose. Little baby things. But not let me become a real firework maker. He wants me to stay a child forever. Well, I'm not going to. Chudak, I've had enough. I'm going to Mount Merpie and I'm going to bring back the royal souffleur. And I'll set up as a firework maker on my own and put my father out of business. You see if I don't." "No, wait, you ought to talk to him." But Lila wouldn't listen. She ran straight home, packed a little food to eat and a blanket and a few bronze coins and left a note on the workshop bench. "Dear Father, I have completed my apprenticeship. Thank you for all you have taught me. I am going to seek the royal sulphur from Rivanzi Fire Fiend. Now she'll probably not see you again. Your ex-daughter, Lila." Then she thought she should take something to show Rivanzi her skill. She packed a few crackle dragons and one of the last things she had invented. It was a new way of setting them off. You just had to pull a string instead of setting light to them. Because the string was soaked with a solution of fire crystals, she put 3 of them in her bag, took one last look around the workshop and slipped away. When Loughton came back and found her note, he read it with horror. "Oh, Lila, Lila, you don't know what you're doing," he cried, and ran out into the alley. "Have you seen Lila?" he asked the fried prawn seller. "She went off in that direction about half an hour ago. She had a bundle on her back." added the Bacchante painter. "Looked as if she was going on a journey." Slouchund hurried after her at once, but he was an old man with a weak heart and he couldn't run fast. The streets were crowded. Rickshaw drivers jolted with block carts and a caravan of silk traders were pushing its way through the market into the Grand Boulevard. A procession was going past. The crowd was so thick that Slouchund couldn't move any further. The reason for all the excitement was that the white elephant had been led to its new owner. Chudak was leading Hamlet at the head of the procession. And with them came musicians playing bamboo flutes and banging teak drums and dancers swaying and snapping their fingers. And a troop of servants with tape measures ready to measure Hamlet's new home for the silk curtains. Flags flapped and banners waved in the sunlight, and the white elephant shone like a snowy mountain. Slouchund forced his way through the crowd to Chulak's side. "Did you tell Lila about Rivanzi and the royal souffleur?" he panted. "Of course," said Chudak. You should have told her yourself." "Why?" "'Cause she's gone, you wretch. She's gone by herself to Mount Merpie and she doesn't know the rest of the secret." Is there more then? "Of course there is," said Slouchund, struggling to keep up. "No one can go into the Fire Fiend's grotto without protection. She needs a flask of magic water from the goddess of Emerald Lake, otherwise she'll perish in flames." "Oh, Chudak, what have you done?" Chudak gulped. They were nearly at the house of the White Elephant's new owner, and they had to slow down to allow all the dancers and musicians and flag bearers to get through the gate first and form two lines for the White Elephant to walk between. Then Hamlet whispered, just loud enough for Chulak to hear, "I'll find her. Help me get away tonight, Chulak. We'll go and take Lila the magic water."
"Good idea," whispered Chulak, beaming. "Just what I was going to suggest." He turned to Lauchend and said, "Listen, I've got a proposition. Me and Hamlet will find her. We'll get out tonight. Emerald Lake Goddess, magic water, Mount Murphy, nothing to it," said Chulak. Then Chulak turned to the servants. "Mind out the way," he called. "We've got a game round the corner. Dear, dear, what a narrow gate. They'll have to come down. What is this, gravel? You want the White Elephant to walk on gravel? Fetch carpet at once, a red one. Go on, hurry." He clapped his hands and the servants bowed and scampered away. In the background, the new owner was tearing his hair. Chulak whispered to Lauchend once more, "Don't worry, we'll get away tonight. All we need is a tarpaulin." "A tarpaulin? Whatever for?" "No time to explain now. Spring onto the gate tonight." And Lauchend had to make do with that. He went back to the workshop feeling heavy-hearted. All this while, Lila had been making her way through the jungle towards the sacred volcano, Mount Murphy. It lay far to the north. She had never seen it until late that afternoon. She came to a bend in the jungle path and found herself beside the river. The size of the great mountain made her gasp. It was far on the very edge of the world, but even so it reached halfway up the sky, with its bare sides in a perfect cone and the glowing crater at the top. From time to time, fire spirits who lived there rumbled angrily underground or threw boiling rocks high into the air. A plume of eternal smoke drifted to the summit to join the clouds. "How can I ever get there?" she wondered, and felt her heart quail. But she could hardly turn back when she'd barely begun. She shifted her bundle from one shoulder to the other and walked on. The jungle was a noisy place. Monkeys gibbered in the trees and parrots screeched and crocodiles snapped their jaws in the river. Every so often, Lila had to step carefully over a snake sleeping in the sun. And once she heard the roar of a mighty tiger, there was no one to be seen except some fishermen. Lablurisi rowing their boat across from the other side of the river. She stopped and watched as they brought their boat in towards the bank where she was standing. They weren't making very good progress. There were six or seven of them. All of their oars were getting in one another's way. As she watched, one of the fishermen missed the water completely with his oar, and which swung around and clumped another fishman on the head. That fishman turned around and punched the first one, who fell off his seat with a squeal and dropped the oar in the water. One of the others tried to grab it, but instead he fell out of the boat, which rocked so violently that the others all cried in alarm and grabbed the sides. The man who'd fallen out was splashing and sputtering as he tried to climb back into the boat. All the crocodiles basking in the shadows looked up interested. Lila caught her breath in alarm, but the fisherman was so helpless that she could hardly stop herself laughing, because when the man in the water leaned over the gunwale, all the men in the boat leaned over that side to help him, and the boat tipped over so far that they nearly fell into it, and suddenly realised what was happening and let go. Then the boat tipped back the other way, they all fell on their backs. and the crocodile slid off the sandbank and began to swim towards them. "Oh, pull him in, you stupid creatures," I cried. "Over the end, not over the side." One of the fishermen heard her and hauled the man over the stern to lie in the barmer, flopping and gasping like a fish. Meanwhile, the boat had drifted into the side, and Lila put out one hand to stop it bumping. As soon as they saw her, the fishermen nudged one another. "Look," said one. "Go on," muttered one of them. "You ask her." "No, it was your idea. You do it." It wasn't me, it was Chang. "Well, he can't say anything. He's still full of water." Finally, one of them snorted with impatience, stood up, making the boat rock alarmingly. He was the stoutest man in the boat, by far the most impressive, for he wore an ostrich plume nodding in his turban, an enormous black moustache and a tartan star on. "Miss," he said, "would I be correct in supposing that you were hoping to cross the river?" He tapped his fingertips together with pleasure. "And would I also be correct in supposing that you had a little money?" "A little, yes," said Lila. "Could you take me across? I'll pay you." "Look no further," he said proudly. "Rambashi's River Taxi at your service." "I am Rambashi. Welcome aboard." Lila wasn't sure why a river taxi should have the name "The Bloody Murder" painted on the bow, nor why Rambashi should be wearing no less than 3 daggers on his belt, one straight, one curved, and one wavy. However, there was no other way to cross the river. She stepped aboard, trying to avoid the man who'd been saved from drowning, who was lying dripping in the bottom of the boat. The others took no notice of him, but rested their feet on him as if he were a roll of carpet. "Cast off, my brave lads," cried Rambashi. Lila sat in the prow and held the size amperentula as the Bloody Murder swayed out into the current. Behind her she could hear the clash of oars and the blade as the blades banged together, the cries of pain as one man's handle struck another man's back, and the groaning and cursing as the half-drowned man began to try to regain his seat. But she didn't take much notice, because there was plenty to look at on the water. There were dragonflies and hummingbirds and the family of ducks for an afternoon cruise, and the crocodiles practicing looking like logs, and all sorts of things. But presently she noticed that the rowers had stopped talking and the boat wasn't rocking unsteadily as it had been when they were rowing. In fact, it was drifting, and the oarsmen weren't entirely silent either. She could hear whispers. "You tell her." "No, I don't want to. It's your turn." "You've got to. You said you would. Let Chang do it. It's about time he did something. He's not fierce enough for you to do it." Lila turned round. "Oh, for goodness sake," she said. What are you?" But she didn't finish the sentence because of the sight that met her eyes. The rowers had put down their oars, which were sticking out in all directions. Each rower had tied a handkerchief over his nose and mouth, and they were holding daggers. Rambashi was holding two. They all jumped silently when she turned round, and they looked at Rambashi. "Yes," he said, "fooled you, ha ha. This isn't a river taxi at all. We're all pirates. The fiercest pirates in the whole river. We'll cut your throat as soon as look at you. And drink your blood," one whispered. "Oh yes, and drink your blood, all of it. Hand over your money, come on." He waved his dagger so vigorously that the boat rocked and he nearly fell out. Lila almost laughed. "Pay up," said Rambashi. "You're captured. Your money or your life. I warn you, we're desperate men."